Over the weekend, Islamic militant group ISIS released the third video of a beheading, this time of British aid worker David Haynes, circulated widely in stills and full form across the internet and through news networks, with the by now familiar desert scene, a victim in an orange jumpsuit, and the executioner in black speaking in a British accent. For an update on all of this and where the response to ISIS stands, including the International Conference on ISIS being held this week in Paris, and Secretary of State John Kerry's efforts to assemble a broad public coalition to confront ISIS, we turn now to Rukmini Callimachi, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome, Rukmini.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So is the video and the ISIS tactics here propelling an international coalition to form or creating more hesitation as you see it?
Yes, I think that the release of the third video is creating even more urgency than before. And part of the irony of this is there's now quite a debate in the United States about the fact that the Foley family, this is the family of James Foley, who was killed in the first video, they have gone on TV to say that the FBI and the U.S. administration did very little to help them when their son was in captivity. And now the brutal killing of him and of two others is essentially bringing America to the brink of another war.
You've written extensively on how Al-Qaeda has used the taking of hostages and the collecting of ransom as a fundraising tool and a tool for growth. I'm wondering if ISIS has suddenly created a market for hostages in that ISIS will bid for Westerners from other groups because they can use them in this grisly propaganda exercise.
Yes, for sure. And do not forget that ISIS was until quite recently an arm of Al-Qaeda. So there's every indication that they have learned at the feet of the master, if you will. Al-Qaeda has now, according to the reporting I've done, raised a minimum of $125 million just in the past 5 years from kidnapping foreigners. These ransoms are being paid almost exclusively by European governments, in contradiction of the numerous treaties that have been signed, swearing that they will not.
You know, I'm wondering if this is a motivation for considering ISIS on a sort of criminal level. The Foley family is suggesting that the FBI didn't do enough. I mean, if this is a case of human trafficking, there is a role for law enforcement here. And if the U.S. is not involved, that could be a lapse. What do you think?
The reporting I have shown has essentially demonstrated that what's happening now is that because European governments are willing to pay ransoms, and I'm particularly citing France and Spain and a number of others, whereas the United States and Britain, for very good reason, you could say, has refused to pay, we're now in a situation where there is a market for Westerners, and the people who are grabbing them don't always know the difference between, you know, a Frenchman and a person like David Haynes, who comes from a country that does not pay.
Are these issues likely to come up at this Paris conference, the difference between the treatment of hostages and ransom demands by Europe and Britain and the United States?
Well, I think it'll probably come up, you know, in the hallways and in the whispered discussions in private conference rooms. What's happened so far is that even though privately officials will tell you that this is the case, I've not yet seen really a global discussion about this issue, partly because I don't think that the United States and Britain want, you know, to have a confrontation with some of their closest allies, including France and Spain.
We're talking with Rukmini Callimachi, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Now, you've spent a lot of time for The Times and particularly for the Associated Press tramping about in places like Libya and other places in the Middle East looking for these kinds of details on hostage taking. I'm wondering if you personally consider that, depending on where you land in your next assignment, there could be a price on your head.
If I could just correct you, I've never been to Libya. I've spent the past 7 years in West Africa, where I've reported a lot from Mali and from the Sahel, which is one of the bases of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, which was the first group that turned to kidnapping to finance itself. And John, the reality is I think about this all the time. And I think it's quite recently, really with the killing of James Foley, that the journalistic community as a whole has started to take kidnapping seriously. I was covering the Mali war last year, and I had some, you know, some unpleasant discussions with colleagues on the issue of safety and on the issue of how quickly I wanted to move north into the country in areas that had just been controlled by jihadists. And I feel that those discussions were based on the fact that I had spent at that point several years watching this trend evolve. Whereas I think most of journalism and most journalists had not yet come on board and realized just how critical this threat is, and especially for Americans and Brits, because we don't have governments that are willing to pay for us. Once we're caught, really we face the worst.
Well, they're certainly on notice now, that's for sure, and it will affect the reporting from the Middle East and this entire story. Rukmini Callimachi, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Rukmini Callimachi is foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. The appropriation of terms like Islamic State and Caliphate and Jihad by ISIS, along with a telltale British accent in the star of the brutal ISIS videos, has been both an offense and a call to action for the sizable Muslim community in Britain, which has certainly become a recruiting pool for radicals bound for ISIS or other groups in the Middle East. Joining me now from London is Dilwar Hussain, founding chair of New Horizons in British Islam, an organization that focuses on reform in Islamic thought. Dilwar, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello there.
What are the conversations like among people in Britain, Muslims in Britain, trying to figure out what's going on here? I've talked with Muslims in the United States who say no one's buying this. What are they saying over there in London?
The Muslims that I'm speaking to just cannot believe that this is happening, are just as baffled and as just as alarmed and concerned as everybody else. I mean, you have to imagine that, you know, there are a billion Muslims across the world, just under 3 million Muslims here in the UK. And for 99.99% of the population, this is just utter nonsense. It's barbarity. Now, unfortunately, there are a few people that somehow have a very skewed, distorted misunderstanding of Islam. And that's why we're saying that this phenomenon should really be called the un-Islamic state. The statement that we saw from David Haynes' brother yesterday when he actually referred to verses of the Quran saying, this is what the Quran actually says. I felt, you know, and I put this on my Facebook status, I felt that he actually understands Islam better than these crazy lunatics do. Mm.
Do they understand something, though, that is maybe darker here and more threatening to all of us? And that is that Westerners and secular Christians and non-Muslims may find the message of ISIS persuasive, not to them, but they think that Muslims in some form are persuaded by this when, as you say, and as we've experienced, in fact, Muslims view this with utter bafflement.
Absolutely, and disgust. I mean, I think the problem here is that there are a group of people in the Muslim world who have locked themselves into this ideology of the West versus Islam, and they're playing that out. These people are very extreme in their thinking. They're jihadists. This is a splinter group from Al-Qaeda, and we know what Al-Qaeda is all about. You know, in their worldview, the West is in conflict and is at war with Islam. And, you know, they don't just mean all Muslims. They mean a very narrow group of Muslims, i.e. just them. So effectively, they are in conflict with the rest of the world. Because Muslims like myself, who are proud British citizens, and that's the vast majority of us here, they would actually regard us as colluding with these Western enemies that they seem to be fighting.
You know, the problem for all of us, again, is that the bafflement on the part of Muslims and the sort of knee-jerk anger that's produced by these videos, and rightly so, among the West, makes it difficult to formulate a response. They're getting the war that they want, ISIS is, and the Muslim community is having difficulty mobilizing against them.
Absolutely. And you know, I mean, you see this in many different social contexts, don't you? When there is extreme violence, when there is terrorism, when there is chaos like that. For some time, the ones that are perpetrating the chaos, I mean, you could see it maybe in, you know, drug and gang warfare. You can see it in mob life. You could have seen it in Northern Ireland when terrorism was happening over there. That those who are driving the agenda, are using violence, are able to continue driving the agenda. Because for some time, ordinary sensible people feel at a loss as to what to do. Now, I think eventually we will have to deal with this, and we are trying to deal with this. There are different levels of solutions. I think you know, your government and our government are now talking about aerial bombardment. And I think at some level we have to have a military intervention, because this is just becoming far too big an issue for us to just talk about and do nothing else.
Well, we're not policymakers. And I'm wondering, though, in rhetorical terms, if the best weapon for you and me is to think of these folks as criminals, not grant them the status of, you know, global powers, but essentially view them the way we would view drug gangs, as
exactly.
criminals, and we send the police after them. And aside from that, we don't pay any attention.
Well, I think there's a lot of common sense there. And that's why in our letter to the Prime Minister, a group of us wrote a letter last week to our Prime Minister, and we said that we should try to delegitimize this group. We should not give them the credence that they are craving and that they are vying for. And I agree with you that that's the place to start. You know, there are a few young people here in this country who look at these people as though they're somehow fighting the global jihad, if you like, or whatever. And it looks sexy to them. And we have to take that away from them.
Dilawar Hussain, founding chair of New Horizons in British Islam, an organization that focuses on reform in Islamic thought. Thanks so much for a fascinating conversation, Dilawar.
Thank you very much.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.